Does cannabis affect cognition?
Treating venous ulcers in the legs.
How are caffeine during pregnancy and obesity in children related?
And keeping bypass grafts open.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. This is going to be posted on April 27th, 2018. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think I'd like to turn first to JAMA Psychiatry this week. This ongoing issue of, gosh, how does cannabis actually impact on people? They took a look, in this case, at youth, at young people. It's a meta-analysis, so admittedly not as robust as a prospective double-blind study. And I'm sure we're going to be seeing maybe some of those as things go on. I think I was really interested in this study because there's so many states that are now allowing cannabis and a bunch of cannabis products to be used for medical uses, including here in Maryland. So in this study of just over 2,100 cannabis users in comparison to 6,600 or so control subjects with minimal cannabis exposure, they just said, okay, so what does this really do with regard to cognitive functioning? Interestingly, and this was all in adolescents and young adults, the population most likely to use this in a recreational sense, they found that, you know what? We really didn't see an impact after 72 hours on cognition in those folks who used cannabis. I think this is a really interesting study. I'm not sure that it's all that informative. I'd like to hear what your thoughts are about it.
Well, Elizabeth, as you mentioned, these are observational studies, especially in this age group. You really can't do a randomized control trial of whether cannabis use affects cognitive function. The concern is that these are individuals under the age of 26 that are having ongoing neurodevelopment, and exposure to cannabis can affect their cognitive function. Although they were able to demonstrate a statistically significant difference in individuals that had cannabis use, clinically is relatively small. And secondly, is it wasn't there if they waited until cannabis use had been 72 hours previous. I don't think this is definitive, but I think unless we look at the data and look at it critically and without previous bias, we're never going to figure this out.
I'm not sure we're really going to figure it out anyway, and it's something that really concerns me because of what you've already mentioned, the fact that there still is increasing neurodevelopment going on in these folks, and in fact, we've established that it goes on throughout the lifetime. What happens if you're a regular cannabis user? Moreover, cannabis is a moving target just by itself. It's been genetically selected, still being genetically selected, to become much more potent in all of these different forms in which it can be obtained. So I'm not sure we know much about dose response with regard to it. And we're seeing it legalized for recreational use increasingly. I'm kind of worried about this.
The other thing you didn't mention is these were short-term studies. We actually need several large-scale longitudinal studies. So I agree with you. On the one hand, it doesn't show any severe effects in the way it was studied. On the other hand, I don't think it relieves any concern that cannabis use is safe in this particular age group.
Let us move from here then to a study that you're going to do. That's taking a look at coronary artery bypass graft patency. That's keeping the thing open. That's in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
It's well known that giving antiplatelet agents after someone's had bypass surgery increases the likelihood that the bypass graft will be open a year after the surgery. And that's because early after surgery, because of the surgical attachment of the bypass graft and the issues related to flow, is that sometimes platelets can actually clump or cause a thrombosis or a clot in the bypass graft. So after it was placed, it clogs up. And it happens in as many as 25% of grafts. And since individuals oftentimes have multiple grafts, it can occur in as many as 40% of individuals. Well, this study showed that if you use a combination of antiplatelet agents, that is aspirin and ticagrelor, that combination is better at keeping grafts open than either one of the antiplatelet agents alone. If you used both of those medications soon after surgery, at the end of a year, about 89% of grafts were open. If you used just either one of the agents, then somewhere between 77 and 83% of the grafts were open.
What about how long did they have to stay on this particular regimen, and what were the risks associated with it?
Well, this was a one-year study. In general, people will remain on antiplatelet agents lifelong. So in answer to your question, we don't know how long people should remain on it, but they should remain on at least aspirin lifelong. There were major adverse bleeding in a relatively small number of individuals, but all of whom were taking ticagrelor. In fairness, this was conducted in people under the age of 80. So we don't really know in individuals that are older that have a higher risk of bleeding what the adverse outcome risk would be. So before we recommend going to two agents, I actually think we need a larger study that looks at the clinical outcomes to see whether use of both of these agents improves outcome, especially in consideration of the major risk associated with it, that's bleeding.
Let me go back to this particular study and ask you, what would you do? Would you just keep people on two agents for a while and then continue the aspirin lifelong?
If you were convinced on the basis of this study alone, I would say take both agents for a year and then switch just to aspirin and a low dose aspirin, somewhere between 81 and 100 milligrams.
Okay, let's turn from here to the British Medical Journal. This was an interesting study taking a look at the association between maternal consumption of caffeine during pregnancy and childhood obesity, clearly a very important public health issue. It's Norwegian. We love those data sets, of course, from those places. Almost 51,000 mothers recruited and their children after singleton pregnancies. Taking a look at, of course, self-reported caffeine consumption, but I thought was really interesting because it was caffeine from all sources, not just coffee, but also chocolate and other things that contain caffeine. Sure enough, they did find a dose response between the amount of caffeine consumed during pregnancy and excess childhood weight. They took a look at this while these kids were growing from infancy until 8 years. And in the very high caffeine exposure group, they saw that that relationship between excess childhood weight persisted up until the age of 8 years. So clearly, once again, observational study, but provocative.
This doesn't prove that caffeine intake in the mother is associated with obesity in childhood. But as you also mentioned, there are several things that lead credence to the fact that this is a true association. It's independent of the type of caffeine. As you mentioned, they looked at chocolate, they looked at soda, they looked at black tea, and they looked at coffee, and there seemed to be a consistency. Secondly, there was a dose-response relationship. That the higher the caffeine exposure, the more likely there was to be childhood obesity. Finally, this has been replicated in animal models, and there is some biological plausibility as well. There's a strong association.
I think this is going to be a tough call to study in a prospective way. I just don't see a lot of pregnant women signing up for, let's give you this much caffeine and see what happens to your child in the long haul.
Because this is a controllable behavior to tell the mothers to use the lowest risk of caffeine possible during pregnancy, and they suggest less than 200 milligrams per day, I think is good advice.
On that note, let us turn to our final one. That's in the New England Journal of Medicine. Pretty common problem, leg ulcers. Should we treat them earlier or should we wait a little bit longer?
And the most common cause of leg ulcers is actually venous disease. I call it venous ulcers, but it should actually be called venous ulceration. And the typical therapy for that is compression stocking. Compressing the leg helps to facilitate healing of the ulcer. In our veins, we have valves that keep the blood flowing up towards the heart. If those valves degenerate, that blood refluxes back into the vein, causes it to distend, and that causes the ulceration. What this study showed was that if we do early venous ablation in conjunction with compression therapy, people heal faster, they heal better, and they're more likely to not have more venous ulcerations over the next year as compared to doing venous ablation late. In these 20 centers in the United Kingdom, they identified 450 patients that had venous ulceration that are all going to receive compression therapy. They were randomized to receive venous ablation in the first 2 weeks that compression therapy was applied versus waiting until after the ulcer had healed or for 6 months after compression therapy had been applied. And sure enough, those that had early venous ablation, their healing time was cut down from 82 days to 56 days, and they were less likely in the next year to have recurrence of the disease.
This turns out to be a really important public health problem and one that I was not really all that aware of. Those ulcers that fail to heal and that wound that can actually compromise somebody's quality of life.
And by the way, you're not alone in that because many times out in the clinical world or clinical experience is people aren't being evaluated by sonography. It's a non-invasive test to see whether they have venous reflux or not. So oftentimes compression therapy is applied and the underlying cause isn't even examined. So this tells us look for venous venous reflux, and if it's there, then treat it early. There's a foam ablation, thermal, there's non-thermal. This didn't address it, although other studies have suggested that the foam therapy was probably not as effective. But this study didn't address that. They let the physician use whichever type they were most comfortable with, and across all the different ways of treating it, early ablation was better than late ablation.
Okay. On that note, I'm going to return to the cannabis and cognitive function on the blog this week. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.